Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Susan Shand and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Susan Shand.
Two men in their 70s are candidates in the Nigerian presidential election on Saturday. Yet, half of the country's registered voters are young people between 18 and 35 years of age. The two men are well known to voters. It is the fifth election campaign for President Isha Muhammadu Buhari, who was a military ruler in the 1980s. Buhari, now 76 years old, is seeking re-election as president. This is the fourth campaign for Atiku Abubakar, the main opposition candidate. Abubakar, now 72, was vice president from 1999 to 2007. The presidential election offers little hope of change for young people in a country where nearly 25% of the workforce is unemployed. Some fear anger over the lack of jobs may lead to violence. In Abuja, the Nigerian capital, student Dorcas Nathaniel is making plans to vote for the first time. "I should be happy, but I'm not happy because the two candidates aren't what I expected," she said. Nathaniel added that she had hoped at least one of the candidates would have policies she could support, but neither did. At 20, she is in the under-35 age group that makes up 51% of Nigeria's 84 million registered voters. John Sunday is a 23-year-old student who lives in a poor neighborhood called Makoko. He said many people there were more interested in getting money from political parties than choosing their favorite candidate. "People are after money. They are not after the future of their children. They are selling their votes," said Sunday, a political science student. Vote buying is not new, but Sunday said for many people in the poor areas, life is getting more difficult. Among those aged 15 to 35, more than 55% are either out of work or not in full-time jobs. Nigeria also has a history of violence at election time. This unrest can sometimes involve criminals paid to frighten voters. It also can result from public anger at fears of voting corruption. Human Rights Watch reported that 8 years ago, more than 800 people died in election-related violence. The 2015 election of Buhari was comparatively peaceful, however. Buhari and Atiku have both sought to consider the needs of those unable to find work in an economy struggling to recover from its first recession in 25 years. The president said the expansion of a nationwide vocational skills program could create more than 15 million new jobs. Atiku wants to expand the influence of private business to create jobs. These include promises to privatize the state oil company and spend $25 billion to support private business investment in the country. I'm Susan Shand.
At sunset every day, loud sounds can be heard coming from the sky in a community just east of Los Angeles. The noises are from parrots. The colorful birds have become part of everyday life there. The parrots leave their waste everywhere, said Haviland Rose Olione. But she and many other community members have gotten used to the birds. Olione said, "They are not quiet at all, but you know it's something that you listen for. Because if I didn't hear them on a daily basis, then I know something is really wrong." Red-crowned parrots are now part of the ecosystem in Southern California. Their ancestors came from Tamaulipas, Mexico, where the parrots are now endangered. The birds were often killed in their native land. But in the United States, they were sold to people as pets. Some of the parrots escaped or were released by their owners. They have since reproduced and grown in number in an area with large numbers of people. They are good at making a habitat for themselves in major cities, and this is what happened in Pasadena and East LA. So these are birds that live pretty much exclusively off of trees that are also not native to our area, said Ursula Heise. She teaches at the University of California, Los Angeles Department of English and at the Institute of the Environment and Sustainability. Since arriving in Southern California, the red-crowned parrots have become such permanent fixtures that they are on the California Bird Records Committee's list of birds in the state. They've been naturalized as California citizens, said Heise. Often seen sunning themselves near a body of water, red-eared slider turtles are also not native to the U.S. West Coast. They also immigrated to the area as household pets. Later, some were released or escaped into the wild. The turtles are native to the central United States, but they have survived in many parts of the country and around the world. Because this species is so commonly exploited for food and the pet industry, it's the one that gets released the most often, said UCLA's Brad Schaefer. He heads the Lacretz Center for California Conservation Science. The success of the red-eared slider turtles and red-crowned parrots in the Los Angeles area has scientists wondering whether a city can be a place to help endangered non-native animals. Schaefer said, "At least it's living in the wild. It's making its own living. It's having the lifestyle that turtles or that parrots should have. It's just doing it in a different place." Heise noted that work crews have put up major buildings and added different kinds of plants in neighborhoods across Southern California. In many cases, this has led to a reduction of biodiversity. The native species had trouble living in the newly created habitat. But the other side of that, Schaefer said, is that new kinds of habitats have been created, in which some creatures could thrive. These artificial habitats could become new homes for birds, insects, or other creatures whose native homes are threatened. Schaefer said any non-native species that is added would have to be carefully chosen to limit the risk of harm to the existing wildlife population in the city and other areas.
There has been a lot of publicity recently surrounding 5G, the next generation of wireless technology for the world. But what is this technology, and how might it change our lives? 5G stands for fifth generation, meaning the next step in the progression of technology to replace the current 4G system. 4G was the replacement for 3G, which came after 2G, and so on. These systems are wireless computer networks. Earlier G systems were designed to improve mobile communication operations. Each new technology brought major improvements in speed and greatly increased network capacity. The new 5G system promises more of the same. It is expected to permit more users to do more things at a faster rate. Higher internet speeds and larger network capacity should result in better performance for device users connected to 5G. However, technology experts say there is a major way that 5G is different than the earlier systems. It will move well beyond mobile network technology to affect many more devices and industries than other G versions. Before we can all use 5G, wireless companies and phone makers will have to complete and deploy a whole new system. New phones and communication equipment must be built. American wireless companies have been preparing for the new system for some time. They have been creating new network equipment and buying broadcasting space to carry 5G signals. They have built new 5G antennas to serve American cities and towns. Wireless providers will invest at least $275 billion in 5G-related networks in the United States, the industry group CTIA reported. The first U.S. launch of 5G is expected to happen sometime this year. Industry experts expect it will take a few more years to go nationwide. It will take even longer to reach rural areas. China is expected to launch 5G sometime in 2020, while European nations are likely to build their systems more slowly over time. In the United States, the first 5G-ready phones should be available in the first half of this year. The first 5G iPhone, however, is not expected until 2020. 4G phones will work on 5G networks, but not at 5G speeds. Wireless industry groups say 5G will help fuel future smart cities by connecting sensor networks. Such networks will be able to control vehicle traffic and quickly identify streetlight outages. 5G is also expected to connect self-driving cars and support new technologies involving virtual reality. Higher 5G speeds could also permit doctors to commonly perform remote medical operations. Factories and businesses could use 5G technology to increase automation and improve the collection of information. More data and many more kinds of data will be traveling across 5G networks. Much of the data could contain private details about individuals, businesses, or government organizations. The increased data flow would give internet attackers a lot more possibilities to steal and misuse data. In addition, the wider use of a 5G wireless network means any breakdown of the system would have more widespread and severe results. Such difficulties could affect public safety as well as world economic activity. Government system failures could create national security risks. A failure during a doctor's remotely guided operation could lead to the death of a patient, or a network breakdown could cause self-driving vehicles to crash. The 5G network has caused tensions between the United States and China. The U.S. government has urged American companies not to use Chinese technology in communications networks because of security concerns. It has also pressed other countries to ban Huawei, a Chinese telecom company, from building 5G networks. U.S. officials have long suspected the Chinese government could use Huawei network equipment to help carry out spying activities. Huawei has rejected such accusations. I'm Brian Lin.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. By the summer of 1862, the American Civil War had been going on for more than a year. The Union had won some battles. The Confederacy had won others. But neither side was in a position to win the war. President Abraham Lincoln needed a major victory. He was losing the support of both politicians and the public. A major victory would not only help him that way, it would also make it easier for him to make an important announcement. For a number of months, he had been planning an announcement about the black people held as slaves in the South. Today, Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe tell about Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation.
At the end of August 1862, Confederate troops under the command of Robert E. Lee defeated the main Union army at Manassas, Virginia. The battlefield was less than 50 kilometers from Washington. The year before, Confederate troops had sent the Union army fleeing from that same battlefield. Now, they had done it again. With this latest victory, General Lee decided on a major move. He would carry the war into the northern states. Lee took his army of 60,000 men across the Potomac River into Maryland. He ordered some of his men to capture the Union position at Harper's Ferry. He moved the others to Sharpsburg, a town on the Potomac River. He put his men into position along Antietam Creek, just outside of town. His lines extended almost 3 kilometers. There, at Antietam, he would make his stand. He was still close enough to Virginia to withdraw if the Union force following him proved too strong.
The Union force arrived in the middle of September. It did not attack immediately. It spent one full day getting into position along Antietam Creek, across from the Confederate Army. It attacked the following day at sunrise. The Union general, George McClellan, planned to attack all along the Confederate line at the same time. But this did not happen. First, Union troops attacked one end of the line, which extended into a field full of tall corn plants. Then they attacked the center of the line, which was in an old, deeply sunken road that gave it good protection. Finally, they attacked at the other end of the line. For each northern attack, General Lee was able to move men to where they were needed. The northern troops got within 25 meters of the Confederate line, but they could not break through anywhere.
On the first day of battle at Antietam, Lee lost 25% of his men. On the second day, the two armies faced each other without firing. They were too tired to fight. As they rested, however, fresh Union soldiers moved into position. Lee knew they would attack with full force the next day. He knew he could not win. Sadly, he ordered his men back to Virginia. It was now clear Antietam was a northern victory. It was not a complete victory. The Union army could have chased the Confederate army and destroyed it. But General McClellan did not do this. He was satisfied that he had stopped the invasion.
In Washington, President Lincoln welcomed the news. He had waited a long time for a northern victory. A few days after the battle, Lincoln held a special meeting with his cabinet. He talked about the Declaration on Slavery, which he had prepared. It would free Negro slaves in the rebel states of the South. "As you remember," he said, "I put the Declaration aside several weeks ago until I could issue it supported by a military victory. The action of the army against the rebels has not been exactly what I should have liked, but the rebels have been driven out of Maryland, and Pennsylvania is no longer in danger of invasion." President Lincoln said he thought the time was right to announce the Emancipation Proclamation. The cabinet made some minor changes in the document, and Lincoln signed it.
Newspapers printed the proclamation. This is what it said.
"I, Abraham Lincoln, President of the United States and Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy, do hereby declare that on the first day of January, 1863, all persons held as slaves within any state then in rebellion against the United States shall then become and be forever free. The government of the United States, including the military and naval forces, will recognize and protect the freedom of such persons and will interfere in no way with any efforts they may make for their actual freedom."
President Lincoln had tried to keep the question of slavery out of the Civil War. To him, there was just one reason for fighting: to save the Union. Nothing meant more to him than preventing the nation from splitting up. Lincoln feared that the issue of slavery would weaken the Northern war effort. Many men throughout the North would fight to save the Union. They would not fight to free the slaves. Lincoln also needed the support of the four slave states that did not leave the Union: Delaware, Kentucky, Maryland, and Missouri. He could not be sure of their support if he declared that the purpose of the war was to free the slaves. As Lincoln waited for a Union victory to announce his Emancipation Proclamation, he wrote a letter to the New York Tribune newspaper. The letter was to prepare the public for what was to come. This is what Lincoln said.
"My chief object in this struggle is to save the Union. It is not either to save or destroy slavery. If I could save the Union without freeing any slave, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing some and leaving others alone, I would also do that. What I do about slavery and the colored race, I do because I believe it helps to save the Union. This is how I see my official duty. It does not change my wish as a person that all men everywhere could be free."
President Lincoln failed to keep the question of slavery out of the Civil War. As the war went on, month after long month, people in the North began to see it as more than a struggle for national unity. They began to see it as a struggle for human freedom. Abolitionists were active. In speeches and writings, they said over and over again that slavery was evil. As public opinion began to change, anti-slavery members of Congress gained more power. By the summer of 1862, they had enough support to pass laws ending slavery in Washington, D.C., and United States territories. They also pushed through Congress a bill that would do much to end slavery in the states.
The bill was called the Confiscation Act. It gave the federal government the power to confiscate or seize the property of all persons who supported the Southern Rebellion. Slaves were considered property, so any slaves seized under the Act would become free immediately. Slaves who escaped from rebel slave owners also would be free. The bill would not affect slaves owned by persons who supported the Union. President Lincoln did not like the Confiscation Act. He thought it interfered with his wartime powers as commander-in-chief.
However, Lincoln was under great pressure from abolitionists, so he signed the new law. But he did not plan to enforce it. He still hoped for a plan that would free the slaves slowly, over time. He proposed such a plan, but only for the border states between North and South. Under his plan, the federal government would buy slaves in the border states and free them. Lawmakers from the border states rejected Lincoln's plan, and that is when he decided to issue the Emancipation Proclamation.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.